You know, every religion in the world gives you principles to live by, without exception. But the Catholic faith is something much, much more. Contrary to popular belief, the Catholic faith does not reduce to a code of ethics, nor is it a monolithic block of doctrine submitted for your approval. One of the best descriptions that I've ever heard to try to capture it all is that it's a story, and you're in it. Now, the story is already complete. We know how the story ends with the death and resurrection and ascension of Christ. We know at the end of all this, God wins. However, your part in the story is still playing out. And one of the most important objectives of faith is not to lose confidence in the author. Keep that in mind as we take a closer look at some of what we just heard. If you ever wanted to understand the Bible, here's a foundational principle to begin. Ask yourself one question. What did people believe the very first time they heard this proclaimed? You want to understand the scriptures? Here's where we begin. What did the first people to hear these words think when they heard them? So Jesus turns to Peter here in the gospel. He says, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answers, "You're the Christ." Question for you. When Peter said that, what did he mean? What was Peter thinking? If you could ask people of Jesus' time what was meant by the Christ, they would have thought not of Jesus when they heard that word. They would have thought of King David. I don't know if you ever heard this before, but King David was the very first one to ever be called the Christ. King David was the very first one to ever be called the Messiah. And you want to know why? It's because the word Christ is nothing but the anglicization of the Greek word Christos, which means anointed. King David was the anointed one. The prophet Samuel anointed David, and he was always known as the Christos, or the Christ, or the anointed. And when you put that into Hebrew, do you know what it becomes? Hebrew word is Mashiach, which we call in English Messiah. It's very hard to overestimate David's importance. He was the warrior king that everyone had been hoping for. He conquered Israel's enemies, united all the tribes of the people, made Israel a light to the nations, answered everybody's prayers. But when King David died, Israel began to decline. They were conquered, they were overrun, they were invaded, occupied, humiliated. And the people began to hope for another Messiah. They began to hope that another Christ would come. Prophet after prophet proclaimed it. Psalm after psalm promised it. Another Christ was going to come, greater than King David. One who would definitively destroy the enemies of Israel, unite all the people, make Israel a light to the nations. And when Peter turns to Jesus and he says, "You're the Christ," that's what he meant. That was the tradition. However, there was another tradition of the Christ. And you heard about it proclaimed in the first reading. "I gave my back to those who beat me. I gave my cheeks to those who plucked my beard. My face I did not shield from buffets and spitting." Isaiah proclaimed it. The Psalms proclaimed it. "He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering, acquainted with infirmity. He was wounded for our offenses, crushed for our sins." All these passages like that, and nobody knew what they meant. Very few people claimed to understand what those meant, and everyone knew about them, and they were very disturbing, and hardly anybody ever talked about them. And now you see why Jesus says what he says here in the gospel. "I'm the Christ you were waiting for. The infinitely greater than King David. The warrior king who will conquer the enemies of God, unite all the peoples, make the God of Israel a light to all the nations. However, He will conquer in a way that nobody expects. Not by the sword, not by politics, not by any worldly power. He'll conquer in a way so far greater than that. It's as high as the heavens are above the earth, although perfectly incomprehensible to human minds. He will conquer by suffering. He's going to win by a cross. Now, to all human eyes, it looks like a defeat. But this is what he means when he says the Son of Man must first suffer greatly, be handed over to the chief priests and the elders of the people, and be killed. What does Peter say when he hears that? He says, "Whoa, Lord, heaven forbid such a thing should ever happen to you." And what does Jesus say in reply? "Get behind me, Satan." Why does he call Peter Satan? Because he opposes the cross. Without the cross, there's no salvation. Without the cross, there's no forgiveness of sins. Without the cross, there's no redemption. Without the cross, there's no heaven. Those are all the things that Jesus wants to save us for. That's why he says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." And you want to know what's interesting? Just as Peter opposes Jesus when he hears about the cross, so do we. We're all in favor of Christ's kingship, but none of us wants to have a cross involved, right? And we say this every time we complain about something that's difficult or painful in our lives. Anytime we say to the Lord, "Lord, if you loved me, you wouldn't let this happen." Every religion in the world tries to answer the question of suffering. But most of them give you nothing more than philosophy. Why do we suffer? Most religions of the world will say, "Why do we suffer?" Well, suffering makes you stronger. Suffering makes you wiser. And that's true. Not a single character trait in your soul that was not somewhere forged in the crucible of suffering. Show me somebody who's never suffered anything, and I will show you someone who is shallow and self-absorbed and the world's most boring dinner conversation. But when you're the one who's suffering, it's not enough for somebody to tell you, "Well, it'll make you stronger, it'll make you wiser." I was at the hospital, and this woman, tiny little baby, had just died. And the woman turned to me and she asked the question of me that she really wanted to ask of God. She said, "Why?" It's not the moment to turn back and say, "Well, it's just going to make you wiser. It's going to make you stronger." Not good enough. Utterly unsatisfying. True, but not complete. You know, the only answer to the question of suffering in the world: the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There are lots of partial answers. The Old Testament gave a partial answer. You know, the book of Job. Job turned to God at the end of all of his sufferings and said, "Why?" And God turned back to Job and he says, "Job, who are you to question me?" It's true, but it's not very satisfying. One answer and one answer only is satisfying. That's the death and resurrection of Christ. And he actually answers it very succinctly right here. "Whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." Two things that means. Number one, no matter how difficult the trial, remember, it's not the end of the story. Like I said, we're in a story. We know how this story ends. Suffering is not the last chapter. The resurrection is real. When this is all over, God wins. And so are all those who are with him in Christ. If there's pain, if there's difficulty, if there's frustration, if what's good and true and beautiful are persecuted, forgotten, rejected, and despised, you can be sure of this: it's not the end of the story. When a loved one dies, people try to offer words of consolation. They'll say things like, "You know, I'm so sorry, I wish I could help, but..." And whatever follows the word "but" is always insufficient. Well-intentioned, but insufficient. Only the Lord actually tells us something that matters, something that's so great that it makes everything else irrelevant by comparison. Because he's going to bring them back. In the resurrection on the last day, in the land of the living, and one of the greatest joys of heaven is going to be the reuniting with all those you've loved and have gone before us. Keep this in mind in times of suffering. The suffering is not the end of the story. That's the first thing that means. And here's the second. It means that God is actually with you in your sufferings. Remember that. Back when I was in the seminary, I worked in inner city Philadelphia, one of the toughest parts of town. Spoke to the Philadelphia police. They said the chance of being a victim of violent crime in this part of town is 50%. And I visited a woman who lived there, 104 years old. And she turned to me and she says, "Does God know what it's like to be 104 years old? Does God know what it's like to be so old that you outlive your own children? That all your friends have died, you lose your hearing, you lose your sight, you ache from head to toe. Does God know what that's like?" Do you know what the answer is? The answer is actually yes. Understand this. Every single suffering that has ever been or ever will be was there on that cross. Want to know why? Because if it wasn't present on that cross, it wasn't redeemed. And it was. He's been there. He's been through your worst suffering and out the other side. And he wants to assure you, it's going to be okay. But the important thing for us as we're going through it is to remember his presence. If you run from the cross, like St. Peter tried to run from the cross, you'll be crushed by its weight. But if you embrace it, you'll find in it a sublime sweetness. A philanthropist wants to alleviate the sufferings of the world. And that's a good thing. We need philanthropists. But a lover wants something much, much more. A lover actually wants to be with the one he loves in their sufferings. And we say, that's exactly what God did. Keep that in mind as you're going through your hardships. You know, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings. Quote I love from him. He once said, "As a Catholic, I don't expect history to be anything other than a long, slow defeat ending in final victory." That's what it means when Jesus says, "Everyone who loses his life for my sake will save it." Everything but everything that's in the Lord will work to your good. God doesn't let us have it easy in this life. Have you noticed? Have you noticed? God does not let his friends have an easy time. He gives you little rests. He gives little breaks, a little bit of boost to help boost your spirit, but he never lets you get complacent. And the reason for that is that you weren't made for this life. We're passing through to a land of promise. This world makes a lousy home, but it makes a great gymnasium. And he's trying to help us, and he's helping us by giving us a share in his cross. It's like what Pope Benedict said so many years ago. God didn't make you for comfort. He made you for greatness. And as Jesus gets closer and closer to his cross, notice this. His friends get fewer and fewer. When he's working miracles, friends all over the place. Everyone's singing his praises. Proclaiming the gospel, mesmerizing the crowds, countless in numbers. The closer he gets to the cross, the fewer friends he has. Do you want to be one of his real friends? Do you want to follow him all the way to the cross? Please remember this. The cross always wins. The cross always wins. That's why I'm so fond of saying that if today you hear his voice, harden not your hearts.